Welcome to the Coaches Forum by These Football Times, a podcast for the progressive football coach, the inquisitive mind, and the lifelong learner for all things football, with your host, John Townsend.
Welcome to the Coaches Forum. I'm your host, John Townsend, and today I am happy to bring on Jamie Hamilton, who writes for These Football Times. He's a coach. He is one of the most talented writers that I've ever encountered. Jamie, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, John. Thanks for the invitation.
Today, we're going to go through quite a few things, Jamie, and I really think that we had a discussion off air, and we've actually had a first take at this, and I think this will be a really good improvement off of the dress rehearsal. So, Jamie...
Let's see.
You know, one of the things that I really... feel is important to do with guests on a podcast like this is to discuss their history in the game. And you strike me as somebody who has taken two approaches to the game, and correct me if I'm wrong. One is a routine, very natural progression as someone who gravitates toward the game. And then another one is a more studious, analytical, almost... dare I say, literature-based immersion into the game as you started writing about it. So where did football and you intersect, and when did you discover the game?
So I suppose that would be when I grew up in the northeast of Scotland, in Aberdeenshire, rural. I grew up on a farm. It's about 30 miles away from Aberdeen. So it was from my dad, I guess. My dad's a football fan. Used to follow Scotland, went to 74 World Cup in, as it was, West Germany, 78 World Cup in Argentina. He was there when Archie Gemmell scored the famous goal that Scots will remember. So he's a fan, and he introduced it to me, and I really got obsessed with it as a young guy. Remember the World Cup in Italy in 1990? It was a big thing for me. I think I was seven at the time, but I was hugely, just completely enamoured with that. And I used to watch all the games live, and I was recording them on VHS and making strange lists of which game was which and driving my parents crazy by using up all the videos. And so I just got obsessed with it, as so many kids do. Started playing for fun, started playing boys club football for the local boys club. Really enjoyed it. Really loved it. I remember watching Football Italia when that started in the early 90s. I loved the it seemed so exotic, all these different players, different names. I was obsessed with AC Milan. That was Capello's Milan, I suppose, at that time. I was just obsessed with it. I stopped playing maybe 15, 16, just because I suppose other interests, school, exams. Went to university in Glasgow, did a degree in marketing, which I've never used, and then went about, with a career in bar hospitality management, nightclub management, that kind of thing. Took me up to when I was, I suppose, took up to when 2013. General manager of a good place, of a good venue, but I got that feeling that this wasn't what I wanted to do forever. I think a lot of people maybe get that feeling at some point in their life. And I thought, well, I need something to replace it with. So what might be a good idea? And I thought, well, what do I like? Because that's probably a good place to start. And I like football. So I've always liked football. And that seemed to be a constant thing as long back as I could remember. So I thought, well, it would be cool to try and make some money out of football in some way, or make a living out of football in some way, to support myself. And I suppose that's what I'm still trying to do. So that's 4 years ago. So I quit my job. I couldn't have really done it pursued football because I was working 6 hours a week or something like that. And you know, lots of people I'm sure can identify with that kind of thing. So I quit that and got a job in a bar owned by some friends of mine, which is far more flexible, more easygoing, which allowed me to go and start coaching at the local club, which is BSC Glasgow, Broomhill Sports Club. From scratch, taking the under-16s. I met some great people that supported me. And as I started learning and doing my coaching qualifications, moved on to the under-17s, then did the U-20s, then got an opportunity to coach the senior men's team, which is in the fifth tier of Scottish senior men's football. Really, really great experience. Coached some really good players. And then got an opportunity as well to manage that team for a short period. Was an interim manager, which is great, having experience of being the top guy, even for just five games, I think it was, at the end of the season, but really cool. BSC decided to go forward with an alternative management team for the new season, which is absolutely fine, no problem. I still had a place there, but I thought it was time to move on, did so, left on good terms. And then I suppose then that would be up to the summer, and then through one connection or another, I ended up getting the opportunity to coach at Airdrie, which is in the League One, which is the third tier of Scottish senior football. So that was great. Unfortunately, that was very short-lived due to, shall we say, a non-football dispute between the chairman and the manager. And I suppose that thing is that you get used to that kind of thing. And that takes me up to where we are now, and looking forward to just getting the next opportunity, hopefully with the same manager that I was with at Airdrie. But we'll see what happens, I suppose. I'm doing my UEFA A licence at the moment, so hopefully, all going to plan, we'll pass that in this May coming. So I think that's something like that.
You have this really interesting journey in that you have always been in the business of people, like dealing with people, right. Handling yeah. people, and then especially at a pub or the bar scene with football. And I yeah. think that that's a unique and quirky interaction. But do you find that your view of football when you started your coaching journey really oscillated between your experience as a young person recording these games, watching the World Cup, and did you see the game change in your journey as a coach? I think a lot of coaches tend to hold the game in some reverence when they played or when they were first introduced, and then as they get into the sticks, into the trenches, so to speak, it becomes different. Did you find that at all?
Yeah, it was kind of a strange one, I suppose, because back in, so it was 2012, and it was the, I hope I get this right, it was the European Championships that Spain won, I think. And I remember watching that one, that tournament, and that Spain team, that great Spain team. And the way they played was just, I mean, I'd never seen anything. We'd seen the Barcelona team, right? And I suppose that was a precursor to it, watching that Barcelona team. I still don't think maybe people realise how lucky we are to actually live at the time of that team, you know.
Right.
It's absolutely crazy. So I remember watching those games, and then that Spain 2012 team, and they just kept the ball. I've never seen anything like it before. And that made me, I suppose, get kind of really sort of reinvigorated my interest in football. I was like, how are these guys doing that? Like, no one else can do that. Like, what's going on there? So I guess I started reading about it a bit more, and then because of, I suppose, the rise of this Guardiola-style football, this Spanish school of football that was, you know, labelled tiki-taka, I started reading about that, and there's lots of, I suppose, interesting, more literary, scholarly pieces written on, like, the philosophy behind this kind of thing. And I got really interested in that, and I still am really interested in that. So that really piqued my interest. And I went into the coaching with this kind of these kind of ideas kicking around. But then, as I started coaching, I suppose, like what you would call a grassroots level or whatever you call it, I realized that very quickly that these kind of philosophical ideas aren't necessarily going to float. You know, it's like you have to try and make the message simple and try and win the game. Try and make the players improve. Probably took me a while. I probably tried to shoehorn my ideas into a situation that didn't fit at the start. But that's learning, I suppose, and that's what always I have to make mistakes to learn. And then as I went forward, I hopefully was more able to realise more that it was more a case of being pragmatic about the situation you're in, and trying to work with the resources you've got, because, you know, you don't have, sometimes you've only got a third of a pitch or something, and, you know, you can't implement some kind of elaborate, you know, positional play system on a third of a pitch, at least. Well, I don't know how to do that. Maybe you can. I realised that that's a practical, pragmatic side to it. But at the same time, I like to keep the more theoretical side of my learning going on. And I think that's really useful because, you can put out some of the ideas you learn. I think you can implement them, even if it's only a small amount. Maybe that small amount's enough to make you better than the team you're playing. So, yeah, it's definitely a two-pronged attack of that practical coaching side and then the more theoretical, which is what I suppose the writing the articles is, me trying to figure out stuff about the theoretical side and how that marries with the reality of it, I suppose, something like that.
Right. And I think when I started coaching heavily, I graduated from university in 2008, and then I went to graduate school.
What did you study?
I studied English literature, and then okay. which explains the writing. And then I got my master's in English as well. And then I didn't know what I was going to do as a career, but I always wanted to coach. And so when I got into it, I remember growing up in an era, and you can maybe attest to this, where coaching books were diagrams and pictures of sequences, not necessarily the understanding of the mental side. And maybe there was some of that, and we just didn't have access to it the way we do now with the internet and digital libraries and even what we're using now, this communication. And I think that I found myself immersed in similar era when Spain began to redefine the way people viewed this game, and you could really identify with the versatility that is possible. And I remember an overflow of information coming my way where I was diving in down these rabbit holes of, there's a whole mental side of it. There's a whole physiological side of it. There's a whole tactical side of it, a whole technical side. And that's true coaching. But I think growing up, the materials that were available for people our age, were similar age, were very minimal in terms of the depth that they went into. And I think that today's emerging coach, and I would include myself and you in this as well, is at a great advantage, but it's also a blessing and a curse that you almost get bogged down in everything. So you get to this stage where you draft or map out sessions, and then you get mired in the theoretical without the implementation or application. Do you find that to be something that has occurred to you? And I'm sure it has, but can you cite an example of when that happened?
Like you say, it can be a blessing and a curse having so much information at your disposal if you're trying to understand and learn something. Because I mean, how the hell do you separate the wheat from the chaff when you're going into it when you're inexperienced in it? And you know, all you have to do is go on Twitter and follow a few accounts, and you're like, man, it's like one guy's saying do this, the other guy's saying do that. This looks like a cool, this has gotten loads of likes, so that must be a good idea. And I think I was probably guilty of, at the start, I mean, of just, you know, you look at sessions on YouTube or wherever it was, and thinking, right, okay, that's passing, okay, that's a drill. And I didn't really understand the game, I don't think, at that point at all, even though I was interested. I'd been interested in it for, you know, 30 years, and I'd read a lot about it, and could talk about it with my friends endlessly, but I actually... And because of the place I find myself in now, which is obviously by no means, you know, an authority on anything, but I know far more now than I did then. So when I look back at myself then, I didn't understand football in the slightest, and I was coaching, right? I was like, but hopefully by, like you say, you do feel like sort of Alice going down these rabbit holes, and it's crazy, but I think you just have to be able to try to understand which rabbit holes are the ones worth going down. I don't know if that's a good way to put it, but yeah, I know I've certainly been guilty of copy and pasting set like in my earlier times, but, you know, taking an idea I didn't fully understand and trying to implement it. And that's a danger. I mean, I don't see how I think everyone's going to fall down that route at some point. It's hard to, unless you have this really great understanding of football from maybe you grew up with it in some sense. And I'm talking about more the theoretical side of the game itself, like the mechanics of how it works. Which I'm still trying to always get my head around. But yeah, for sure, there's definitely problems with the amount of information that's thrown at young coaches, for sure.
I can take it one step further. I think worse than copy and paste, which I don't think it's that bad, to be honest. If it works for you, it works for you.
Yeah.
I remember my early days. Now I am secure enough to admit this now, but back in a couple of years ago, I would be completely avoidant of this, where I would actually adopt a personality that wasn't necessarily my own, because I grew up with that personality coaching myself. And so I was like finding myself as this authoritarian, blunt delivery. Oh, and then all of a sudden I was
Gary, like, John.
this isn't me. And then it was finally until two quotes come to mind. Was someone said that your players are going to listen to the delivery before they ever listen to the message. So understand that. And then another one was, if you are a good coach or you are a good person, that means that you have messed up at some point in your life more than you think you have, which is
really
interesting.
You mess up every day. I mess up every day.
But yeah. And so if you are considered, good's too much of an umbrella description, but if you feel like you are improving, that means at some point you were in the dregs of it all. And I think that that's a really interesting coaching point for anyone to just digest.
Yeah,
because
that's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting what you said about the persona thing, about you changing, because I didn't have that in football so much, but I think that I had that when I was first ever given the responsibility of being in charge of people, which was not in a football context, but it was in a bar context. I think I definitely fell into that trap, for sure. But I think I'd had, maybe 10 years experience of managing people, let's say, which I think there's transferable skills. I mean, there is. There's no doubt about that. Of course there is. It's like you're trying to get a group of people to do what you want them to do. And hopefully they want to do it for you. So, I mean, in that sense, it's completely transferable. Those leadership humans aspects of it, you need to learn the game and the mechanics of the game, just like you would need to learn the mechanics of a restaurant or a bar, whatever discipline it is, the overriding management, if you want to call it, I think is pretty transferable a lot of the time.
There's a great book that I've just finished. It's called The Chimp Paradox by Dr. Steve
Peters. I've never read it. Yeah, I've not read it.
Oh, it's brilliant. But the thing about for I wish I would have had this as a player. I'm glad I have it as a coach. But I don't want to do a disservice, but I'll give a really brief summary of what I took from the premise of the book, not the whole book itself, but just that I think a lot of coaching, especially growing up in the 80s and 90s, like we did, and even the early 2000s with some of this stuff, was the human mind is divided into three components, according to the book. The computational, which is storage and memory, the human side, which is logic, and then the emotional side, which is the chimp. And the fascinating part about this book is, and I read this in Steven Gerrard's latest book, which is for his whole career, he had a hard time managing the chimp, which is the emotional, the outburst. It's the strongest part of your mind. It's the first to develop. And then they even equate, the average chimp is 5 times stronger than a human in strength, in applicable strength. So you can imagine that the war going on internally, or the conflict going on internally, if you're trying to manage people, is this oscillation between the chimp and the rational mind, and then the computer remembers both and locks both. So now you're sitting. Okay. So you will enjoy the book, and I think anyone listening will enjoy the book.
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways that I've seen people sort of split. I mean, I'm no expert on these kind of things, but they've split the brain up and made these models. But the general idea, I think got the right, you tell me if it's not, but there's a battle within yourself first. that's what's going on. And it's easier to rule a city than it is to rule yourself. And it's like, I think that's really true. That really hits home to me because it's difficult to manage all these different conflicting emotions that you have all the time. And if you're going to be in charge of people, like, they can see through that pretty quick. If you're not able to hold some kind of coherent idea, some kind of coherent presence, I think people can see through that pretty quick. I think it's important, well, for me anyway, to try and make sure that I understand myself in some way, for sure.
One of the greatest classes I took as a graduate student was I had to take an elective, which was a philosophy class, and it was a philosophy of sport class, and we've discussed this before, you and I, but talking about Aristotle's description of the human. And the human condition is you're still an animal, but you're titled rational animal. And I think in many ways, we as coaches tend to combat the animalistic part, trying to make it too rational. But at the same time, we don't want to create robots either. Where do you find yourself in that discussion or that premise?
I think for that, it's so interesting because I think that absolutely. It's the rational mind and the irrational mind, or the unconscious and the conscious, whichever model you want to look at it. And I think you have that in football as well. You're right. You have empirical football, let's say. There's more rational a data-oriented side of the way people interpret football, and also the objective football theory. This is it's more of a rationalistic interpretation of what the game is, which is really useful because it's great to be able to describe what things are, and that's the scientific method, I suppose, which is great. So useful to understand the way things work and the nature of things, absolutely. But then you have this thing, you have this, like you say, this chimp side of it, right, or unconscious side of it, this instinctive side, because it's played by human beings, and human beings kick off in weird ways sometimes, and especially in a high adrenaline, high octane environment like a football match. I mean, I remember when I was put in charge of this interim manager position for BSC Glasgow. In the first game, my heart was pounding. It was crazy. You know, it's like you're on the touchline. This is happening. I love football. I love the immediacy of football. It's unfolding right in front of you. And you see people lose it all the time. I mean, the most seasoned professionals, coaches, players, you know, you can't. I'd say it's impossible to completely control yourself, which is maybe why I like it and why so many people like it, actually, because... Yeah, you can't control yourself. It's a strange thing. It's a battle, I suppose. But I think it's dangerous to become too rationally minded and block all that out, because then it will become this kind of laboratory experiment or something. And yeah, this very robotic thing where people's emotions are not allowed. You know, that's what the clamp down on the emotional side of the game, which I think would be a real tragedy. But we have to be careful. Because, I mean, even do you remember this season? Who was it? Sterling, I think, scored a last-minute winner against Bournemouth. Do you remember that one?
Yep.
And he ran to the crowd, and he got booked, and he got sent off. I think it was the last minute. And I thought, well, I mean, what's he supposed to do? He just scored a winning goal in the last minute of the game. His fans are right there. You know, they've travelled all the way down the length of the country to watch the game. I mean, the adrenaline must be going absolutely crazy in Raheem Sterling. And he runs to the crowd and he celebrates, but that's an offence now. And OK, I understand the safety element of it and all that kind of thing, but I just think sometimes it's like, he's not in control there, you know? And you're trying to control the uncontrollable.
I was just about to say that exact phrase, and I think the idea that you can control chaos is a dangerous one.
It's naive.
It's naive. And one of the things that I find at the academy level or even youth football level, at least here in the States, is people try to control the game, and I'm guilty of this, to the point where they place aesthetics ahead of functionality in terms of their coaching delivery and their expectations of the players. Do you see that play out? And you wrote a great article, like, what is good football? The role of aesthetics in the modern game. I think that's a loaded term, isn't it?
Yeah, I just think I actually object to like the fundamental definition people have of football aesthetics. Mm. I think it's wrong. I think it's not right because you know people say that you know because again, stop me if you think I've got something wrong here. But I hear a lot of people say take Guardiola for an example, use it because it's a current one and it's a popular one. I think it's a good example to use. But you know they'll say he cares more about the aesthetics than you know he's an aesthetics coach. It's like well. I don't see that. I see him as a deeply pragmatic guy that wants to win football matches. He has his own way of winning football matches, right? As every coach should have their own. I suppose that's what this term football philosophy should mean. But that, again, that's a term that gets bastardized beyond belief, and you just, I don't even know what it means. So he has his idea of how he wants to win the game, and he implements it. Like he uses it as a tool. He says, right, these are my tools to win the game, which is my objective, and I will do it. And it happens to involve short passing and combination movements. Cool. And people find that aesthetically pleasing. All right, no problem. But it doesn't mean that is aesthetic football. I mean, Simeone plays in a completely different way. But again, I think there's beauty in that too. It's a more rugged beauty, maybe more visceral. But, you know, it's like if you don't only watch or like only like one kind of art or like only watch one kind of movie. It's like there's different genres to it, you know, and it depends. So to say that Guardiola is more aesthetically pleasing than Simeone. It's merely a subjective thing. It's not true, I don't think.
I think groupthink is a dangerous thing, and it happens. I think social media has really highlighted groupthink, but the media does as well, and I think the football-consuming populations do. And I think this goes back, you mentioned Guardiola, and they played Napoli, and someone asked him, a journalist, and Pep is getting into the debate of, he hasn't said it yet, but almost to a journalist. Did you play the game that you're asking this question about? And he would never do that, I don't think, because it does.
You can see the exasperation.
Yeah, but the Napoli plays a very unique style.
Very cool style. I love
very Sarri's great style. And someone asked, "Well, why are you playing out of the back?" I'm paraphrasing here. Against that team, it's dangerous. And Pep says, very bluntly, says, "If I play direct with that team, that ball is coming right back." And he motions with his thumb back to his face, like that's coming right back to us, and we're going to lose. And to your point, to us or to anyone watching at a very surface level, maybe the 10,000-foot view, it does seem aesthetic. But to him, that's functional. That's pragmatic. Yeah. That's the way it is. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think so. And I think you're right about the group thing, because that's what – because you've grown up in this, let's say, a cult, and, you know, football has cultures, and maybe you've grown up in a UK football culture, which doesn't or hasn't had coaches like that. Maybe I'm doing some people a disservice. Well, I don't know. I don't think so, because Guardiola's method is pretty – I mean, it's very, I guess it has principles in Cruyff and Holland, but it's pretty new. I mean, I've never seen anything quite like it before. So when you see it, you have to break – what you think, because this is proving you wrong about what you think. So because in Europe, you're being told never do that, never pass the ball back to the goalkeeper in front on his goal. I saw Edison, he's controlling the ball with the studs on his goal line. You know, he's so cool, and he just moves it across to the other centre back at the other side of the box. I mean, this is what you're told not to do that. So, you know, and yet that becomes ingrained in your mind, and you think, right, that's football, that never do that, you have certain rules. So when you see people break the rules, it's very easy to say, no, that's wrong, that's crazy, what are you trying to do? That's not how you play football. But that's, I suppose, you know, it's because that's the way you've believed it, and that's the way you've talked about it for a long time. And if you turn out to be wrong, it turns out that you've been wrong about football the whole time, which is not an easy thing for someone to accept if their life is talking about football. Right. So, because you have to eat some humble pie, and you have to say, it doesn't have to be like that. I think the fun is finding out new things, and the danger comes when you attach yourself personally to ideas. I think that's dangerous, because if such a time comes where that idea shows to not be as great as you thought it was, you can have a hard time separating yourself from it. And that's when you hear this cognitive dissonance, this groupthink, confirmation bias, and people kind of spin these wild narratives to try and prove themselves right. I mean, so they don't have to change their opinion. And you're like, change is good. Like that's what it's about. Imagine what's the alternative? You just think the same now for the rest of your life. That's pretty dull.
I think people are so scared of being wrong, and I think being wrong is probably the best thing you can be at a certain point. I think sometimes you learn more in being wrong than you ever do in constantly succeeding. I read a really good quote. I forgot where it was from, but it was, if everybody could be great all the time, we would be a pretty boring society. And I think
But that's utopia, which can never happen, right?
Correct. Like, correct. Yeah. And I think what people aspire to, especially football coaches, is they put themselves on the level where they haven't yet done the work, or they haven't yet had the resources or the experience or all of it, where they compare themselves to the world's best managers or the world's best teams. And it's like, emulation's dangerous. It's good, but it's also,
it's absurd though. It's patently absurd. I mean, the people they're comparing themselves to are giants of the game that have won, you know, European cups and like multiple times. I mean, come on. I mean, it's just madness.
It is, and I think it's again, we follow this groupthink where we want to subscribe to the latest and greatest. And I think sometimes I don't use you and me as this example, but as coaches, it tends to border on the verge of insanity by repeating these patterns of, you know, putting your flag in the ground and being unwavering in this. And it's almost a stubbornness and an arrogance that seems to perpetuate the modern coach. But again, I also see some of the most progressive minds and the most promising minds come out of, this day and age where they are studying, they are admitting they're wrong.
Oh, for sure.
They are reflecting. In their coaching practices.
It's nothing wrong. I mean, God, I'm inspired by these people for sure, and I admire them, and I look up to them, and try and learn things if I can from them. Absolutely, but I try. I suppose I just try it and take them from as wide a range of places as possible and not become fixated on one, on someone else's idea of football, because that's not mine. So, you know, I don't want to just do a bad job of replicating someone else's idea, because that's not fulfilling. I think it has to be natural to your own, and your own ideas. And, you know, I don't, if you can take a little bit, for it's kind of like cooking in some sense. I don't know, you take a little bit of flavor from lots of different people, you mix it up and something comes out that's kind of your own. I suppose it would be, not that I'm saying I can do that or achieve it, but in my mind, that's maybe how more it should work than just being a disciple, a blind disciple of one way of thinking. Yeah, because yeah, you're just gonna, yeah, it's you're gonna appear, essentially you're just a plagiarist, really.
So let's extend this now, because we've talked about aesthetics, but I think people in the pursuit of aesthetic football forget the objective of the game, which is to win. Where do you fall in this debate? I think you are one of the select number of coaches, I include myself in this as well, where you would rather, or I'll say it for myself, and you can. I would rather win the game playing the right way, but if the right way is to win the game, you kind of back yourself into a corner here where...
What's the right way,
John? Right, exactly. Because at the end of the day, players enjoy... you know, victory, and they enjoy competition. They enjoy struggle sometimes. And I think in the pursuit of creating an aesthetic, we create drones, we create robots, and we create players who don't think for themselves. We create coaches who joystick them, and we forget the overall impact and objective of the game is to win. What do you think?
Yeah, well, for a start, yes, I think the objective of football is to win, because it's a game. And when you play a game, by definition, the objective is to win. And because you have this discussion now and again with some people I know, and the example I give is, you know, if you're sitting around playing Monopoly at Christmas time and you know, no one wants to win, then it's a waste of bloody time. You know, it's not fun. There's no enjoyment there. There's no learning. There's no anything. For me, the learning and the enjoyment comes from trying to do something well against someone else who's trying to beat you. And it's like, you know, that's what makes it fun, the competition element of it. So I always think that winning, playing any game, the overriding objective is to win, for sure. So in terms of how do you get that through, why does that affect how you coach? I suppose that's why I like the idea of having an objective football theory and understanding of the mechanics of what football is. And we're fortunate enough to have some work by smart people that have broken the game down into moments and principles that I think that I like. I'm not saying that it can ever be improved upon or it can't be proved wrong or anything like that. But the way that the game's broken down, I think, is useful to know if you're a coach, and it's useful to know the logical, rational mechanics of how a football match works, because then you can understand the tools that you have at your disposal to teach the players. So, you know, maybe one of those tools might be to react quickly after you lose the ball. That seems like a good thing. That's a tool, right? It's a counter press, or it's a whatever you want to call it, a defensive transition. Just for an example, that's one tool. And you think, yeah, okay, because I want to close the time and space of the opponent when they've won the ball, because that's a good opportunity to stop them. Build it. It's a good opportunity because that's when they're least effective, because they're maybe trying to orient themselves. They've just made a tackle. They're not set up. The opposition aren't set up in an attacking structure. So if you can get them right there, then that's a cool thing to do. So there's a tool. So it's right. So, you know, okay. So when we lose the ball, we want to move quickly to try and close the space again, and that's a tool. So you go, okay, and that fits with the logic of objective football theory of closing the time and space of a player immediately on the moment you've lost the ball. And then you think, yeah, okay, that's a tool. How many of these, and there are plenty of tools like that according to the principles of football, how many tools can I implement to my players? So when I watch someone like Sarri or Guardiola, it's like, man, it's like they've implemented every tool. They've given them every tool. And that's supposed to something works towards something like total football, because you're using all the tools that are available to you. Maybe you can't do that, or maybe you want to just emphasize one more than the other. And like Roger Schmidt, well, he's like just like hyper to counter press. It's like supercharged. And like, well, he thinks, okay, I'm gonna use this tool, but I'm specialized at this tool. Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna have an edge. This specialization of this tool is gonna give me an edge. And so it's really interesting. And I suppose it depends on A, yourself as a coach, your idea, but B, the resources you have, what space you have, how much time with the players. But yeah, I definitely see it. I start with the theory of football and think, okay, which of the tools that I think are going to be best applied with this in this situation that I'm in. It's something like that.
You wrote a fascinating article last October. It's called "In Support of Good Football: Why Identity, Geography, and Opinion Don't Matter." And you start this article, and I encourage everyone to read it on These Football Times. But it's this question, this loaded question of who do you support? And we balance tribalism, and as coaches, like, oh, if you're a coach and you don't like Man City now, and you didn't like Barcelona then or Bayern Munich then, I think we fall into these silos. And you say, well, I support whoever's playing good football. I don't care where or by whom it's being played. It is the action on the pitch that interests me, not the identity of the protagonist. Not only do I love that response, but I think that that leads us to a bigger conversation, which is, you know, these things, you know, geography and I think culture matters, but these opinions that are somehow confined, like how have we confined opinions in invisible lines on ground, you know, like that that border in, you know, what made you write this and can you kind of expand on it?
I suppose that sort of sentiment, I suppose, is just what more like an exasperation at the way that this idea of aesthetics is commonly put forward, I suppose, in football discourse, because I just don't see it like that. I mean, I think that if a group of individuals are carrying out exactly what the coach has asked them to do, and that has won them the game, then I think that's great football. That's the way I think it. And it doesn't matter if you want to have the ball, maybe you want to play against the ball. You see. I think a lot of the stuff like you see coming in of Roger Schmidt, Red Bull, Leipzig do it a lot. That this kind of model, which is new and really interesting to me, because I think it's new, and it's almost like they want to play against the ball. They want to say, "No, you have it, and we're just going to steal it." We're so well organized and so aggressive and so well structured and disciplined in the pressing system and the pressing schemes that you don't want the ball against us. You know, it's like
right.
Yeah, you know, when we have like that, and it's almost going to get to the stage where you can imagine a team saying, actually having the ball and giving it away and saying, no, you have it now you're in trouble. You know, and it's like, well, wouldn't that be crazy? You know, why not? You could design a system like that. So when I see, you know, the stuff coming out of the Red, I like the way, and it's a controversial, but I like the way Red Bull do go about their football. I think it's smart. They seem to have a very cool way of implementing a certain style of system. It's like engineered, you know. It's like something like, I don't know, it's like they're running their Formula One team. It's like they're looking for this like aerodynamic kind of weird innovation, and it's really cool to watch. I know they get a hard time from people, but I think that's pretty hypocritical, to be honest. It's good, you know. But yeah, I think that to me is as interesting and as nice to watch as Sarri's Napoli, which is different again to Guardiola's Man City. So I guess what I was getting at there is that it's how well you carry out these principles and in accordance with winning the game, rather than, you know, anything else. There's a Spanish style, Italian style. I don't know. It's just like what you're doing on the pitch. That's interesting.
There was a time in the late 2009 when I found myself in watching some German football, and I remember, I think it was Borussia Dortmund, but it was a game where they continually pumped the ball forward and didn't concede a goal kick to the other team, but they pinned them in, so they had to throw the ball in, and then they augmented their shape to just suffocate them in that defensive third. And there was no attempt to play through the middle, play out of the back. It was this really high press, and I think Klopp eventually, when he came to the club, refined that a bit and made it a bit more aesthetic. But I think I'm using that word again, but it was unlike anything I've ever seen, because it was, you know, I'd rather pin you in. And this is Germany, a progressive football nation. This is, you know, they're at the point, they're en route to the World Cup, final and winning it and everything. And they're going through this transformation. No one really is understanding that within that system, there's still teams in Germany that were willing to absolutely play what people label anti-football or something else. And it's like, well, no, it's not anti-football. It's football. It's just a different style and doesn't subscribe to the group think everyone else is subscribing to.
Yeah. And that's a good example. And I think that, you know, cause I mean, that's what happened, isn't it? I suppose this, this guard, this I suppose we're talking about this age we live in because we're in it now, so it's quite easy to talk about it. But yeah, this is what happened with this Barcelona team, which I think is like an anomaly to get. It's like a lining of the planets or something, having all those players and that coach and that club at the same time. I mean, you know, you can watch the YouTube games of the 5-0 Real Madrid, the Manchester United, the Wembley European Cup final. Man, it's football from another planet. This is crazy stuff. and you know, it's like wild, you know. And this, because of the impact of this, this whole generation of people seem to become indoctrinated with this idea that you must always have the ball. And it's like, well, no, you don't. Now, who says that? It's just because, I mean, that's the way the Guardiola coaching style says, that's fine, great, no problem. And it works for him because he knows how to do it. But, you know, it doesn't mean that's not the way to play football. I mean, who says that? Anyone who says that's like a fascist or something.
Sure. I think it leads us into what a lot of coaches fall into, and I fall into it all the time still. I can admit that, is the appeal to authority, which is, you know, lots of people did it, therefore it's right, or someone really good did it once, therefore it's the right way, or someone who coached someone really good did it, therefore I should do it. I think that fallacy is loaded, and we all fall into this trap, but I think what is interesting is, you know, it's a bad approach to achieve, you know, promoting one thing because of someone else's ideals. And I think what, you know, emulation is only part of the process. And there's a stark difference between process and procedure. And coaches, you know, even the common fan needs to understand that it's better to assess somebody based off of, I think, results than a series of events than ideas. You know what I mean? I think if they're winning and it's the way they do it, then assess them on that, not on what you think they should be doing, if that makes any sense.
Okay. Yeah, because football is a game played in reality, right? And it's like, and the objective is to win. So do you win or not? I mean, it's all very well. Like, I obviously include myself. It's all very well spouting forth all these things about, you know, this is football and blah, 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 blah. But, well, show me, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where you get that, see, that kind of Guardiola has that exasperation, right? It's like, you're telling me how to play. Like, you know, it's that old adage, show me your medals, right? And there's some truth in that. You know, these there are truth in these things. They get scoffed at, you know, as being that's the real football men and that's the old-fashioned way of thinking. But football is played in reality by human beings. And you know, that's not the acid test. Do you win or not? That's the Mourinho made that comment on Wenger, didn't he? The specialist in failure. It's like, you know, that was completely around that type of idea. The thing is, I suppose people get very touchy when you start talking about development football and you must win all the time. You know, people don't like that idea because they have the idea that, you know, it's for young players. It's got to be about fun and learning the game, which I absolutely agree with, by the way, for sure. It should be a fun environment, enjoyable to be there. Perhaps when I was there doing, you know, playing football at boys club, maybe I didn't enjoy it so much. But so I think it really is important that it's a good atmosphere. But I think that the objective of winning is still the overriding the superordinate principle of everything, because you don't care if they win now in this game and every match, and you don't go around telling people how many goals you beat the other team by if you're talking about 9-year-olds, but you're teaching them things that will hope will help them win future games across time, because you know you're teaching them to open their hips and open their vision, because you know that doing that will help them win future football matches. Not, you know, if winning didn't matter, you just tell them to run around in a circle or something, and run backwards, do a handstand, because winning doesn't matter. We'll do anything then. It's chaos if you take away the principle.
So we talk about these different platitudes and ideas and models. You've written two articles on a pretty polarizing figure in football social media. Someone that I have actually... I'm not a fan of his social media presence, but I am a fan of the things that he writes and does, and Raymond Verheyen. And so, I think that there was who was it on? It was in the UK. Somebody was, it brought him on, I think, TalkSport, and referred to him as like the fitness trainer or something like that. And I want to say it was Ray Wilkins, but maybe I'm, but the point was, it was a clash of ideology between, what people perceived Verheyen to be wrong about and what he actually was presenting and repeating and basically propping his work up against scientific, empirical, objective data sets and findings. Where do you find yourself in this this argument or this debate? Because you've written at length twice about this, more than anybody else has, really. Most people just subscribe to it or denounce it. Where do you find yourself?
Well, so I think it's just really, interesting, which is why I suppose I was writing about it because, I've not been to his World Football Academy. I've not paid for the because they do a lot. I mean, they do lots and lots of these seminars and courses and all this kind of thing. I've actually never been to any of them. So this is only my interpretation of what it is. I'm not going to say what he's doing because who am I to describe it? But I can say what I get from it. And from the books and listening to him and the interviews and that kind of thing. And what it seems to do is he gives a very rational, very reasonable, I think, interpretation of the breakdown of what football is, of the scientific empirical nature of football. But in my view, that's not the only part of football's nature. It has the irrational side, as we talked about earlier. It has a very irrational human side to it. But what Verheyen does for me is able to really package quite nicely the empirical stuff into one of his real fundamental principles, which I really like, is his desire and demand for simple football, a universal football language, which I think so important. I mean, that is the most important thing. I mean, because if you ask 10 of your players to write down one paragraph, or define pressing, define the word pressing. I wouldn't be surprised if you get 10 different answers.
Sure.
And you can take that up to coaches. On my UFA license course, you get 10 different answers. What are we talking about here? I mean, how can we communicate? How can we get these ideas across if we don't even know what words mean? Like, this is a serious problem, in my view, and one that Verheyen takes very seriously. And I think, if anything, one thing that people can take away, if people are very sceptical about him, because I know he's very obstinate and he's very opinionated, but, you'd see through that, get past that. It's not the end of the world, maybe he doesn't care if he hurts your feelings, but, that's okay. He's not here to mother you. if we can get past that, and there's one important thing to try and take away from it, is that, and there are plenty, I think, this need to try and define terms and understand what they mean, because otherwise we're just talking past one another, and it's really difficult to try and organize any kind of methodology, or especially if we're talking about implementing a national training program or training curriculum or coach education curriculum. If words don't have meaning, then we're in big trouble. And I think football falls into that trap a lot.
There was one part of his delivery on a number of case studies that he does on social media where he takes Klopp or Mourinho and he slaughters them. But I begin to see more why now, because at surface level it's like, what? How could you? How dare you? You're not even coaching. Yeah. It's real chimp. The chimp comes out. But I was at a running lecture, so endurance.
You run, right? You do endurance.
I do,
running,
yeah,
is that right?
I do. I do. So I do ultra marathons, anything up to 50 mile foot races.
I did one marathon once. It took me over 5 hours.
It's the best and worst thing on earth. I think I did a half marathon a couple of days ago, and it was the worst I've ever run. So it doesn't matter how it's just like football, right? Like, you don't know what to expect. I think you even said last time we spoke, what we don't know is infinite, but said something really interesting, and I took this from this running seminar that I attended, which was, use caution with training too far out of what your players will actually encounter. And these are my words, but he says this in some way. He goes, and this is the difference between conditioning and pacing. And a lot of runners and a lot of young football coaches and parents of young footballers and even anybody, really, they fall into this trap. The premise is, I'm going to train 3 hours so that 90 minutes feels very easy. The problem with that is the pacing is way off. It's almost as if it's geared to sustain 3 hours but not optimize that 90-minute segment. And this gets into this idea of you're either adapting or optimizing. And I think Verheyen is one of the few who hits that principle, which is freshness versus fitness. And I think a lot of people are very scared to admit that optimization is much different than conditioning, and pacing is much different than conditioning. And I think you have to run a marathon, whether it's in 5 hours, 10 hours, you know, 3 hours, to understand the difference. Do you agree, or where do you find yourself under in that?
So the fitness stuff, again, I am not a biologist, I'm not a physiologist, I'm not a scientist. I don't know medically about the functions of the body, and I don't purport to, right? I don't know, right? So I am completely, I have to try and take my model from somewhere, right? As a football coach, because football is a physical game. It's, you know, it's an athletic sport, but I do not know about how that works. And I try and learn, I try and pick things up, right? But you know, that's not my domain. And I'm really grateful to people like Graham who simplified these things and explained them in a manner that seems reasonable to me. And to give your players the right training load and to train them to play football. Football is a game of actions. So, and when you're playing a game of football, you're completing football actions. So therefore, to train football fitness, you should train football actions and try and increase the intensity and quality of those actions, rather than running around in a circle. That makes sense to me. He explains it in a way that makes sense to me, anyway. And that's what my articles were about. I think a lot of the time was saying, well, okay, because his ideas make sense to me. So, I've not heard a good rebuttal of the idea. All I hear is he's an asshole, right? And you're like, well, okay, well, fine. I don't care. Okay, whatever. I'm not
given
interested.
That, yes.
It's another logical fallacy. You mentioned one earlier on about the argument from authority. That's an ad hominem, and
sure.
It doesn't flow. So you know, don't. It's just so boring. It's like, well, if you've got an actual problem with the man's, you know, rationally thought out, empirically natured model, then I'm more than willing to hear it, because that would be great for me, because then I would know something different, and I know why it's wrong. But I don't know why it's wrong. So how can I criticize it?
I was stood in a room with some professional coaches, some former national team coaches here in the States. And I'm a pretty polarizing figure here in the States. I write some stuff that is against.
It's usually a good sign to be hated by
most sides. Yeah. And so one of the coaches, and he'll remain unnamed right now, because people, when they hear this, probably know who I'm talking about. But he said, you know, tell me what you think coaching should be about at the highest level. What's the truth in coaching? You know, and pointing to me, because I'm the lowest on the in the room in terms of licensure. And I said, well, a lot like science, I think football coaching or soccer coaching is not about finding truth, but it's about reducing uncertainty. And the looks that people gave me were, I think they, one, it's correct. I don't think there's one universal truth. There's no unicorn. But it's not about proving. It's about reducing, so minimizing the defeats you have, or minimizing the players you don't retain, or minimizing the mistakes you make.
Kind of mess up less, right?
Exactly.
Basically.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned something last time we spoke about, it was something literacy, which was, it had to do with that topic itself, right? It's technical stuff, but also just the application of coaching, the purpose of coaching, which is, you know, we're not going to solve everything, but we're going to reduce the frequency of said, you know, results or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
And I think so much of what Verheyen represents is and what you've written about is, you know, we're mostly wrong, no matter what, until we study and test, and then we get less and less wrong through trial and error.
Yeah, so exactly. So that's a good way of putting it. So to me, Raymond Verheyen is a way that I can hopefully be less wrong about the nature of football. That's basically it. And I'm, you know, and I'm sure that, I mean, and again, like I said before, I don't assume that his model will be the one that defines football for the next century. I'd imagine someone's going to come along with hopefully an upgrade, you know, but an upgrade based on critiques of his ideas and improvements on them. And then we'll see what happens. But, you know, that's how it works, right? But until that point, if people's only problem with it is that they don't like the guy, then I'm sure that's not going to persuade me for sure.
Right. So let's shift gears here. You once did a fascinating YouTube essay on you did a couple, but one of them was on isolation training, or as we call here in the States, I'm sure in the UK it's similar, opposed versus unopposed training. And
Unopposed.
Oh god. And so I made my mark on the football writing world inadvertently by watching some local teams play here at the professional level, noticing how bad it was technically. And then somebody in a coaching course asked me, you know, well, what do you think about, you know, how do you get players to be better technically? It's an unfair question, but because there's so many. But I just said, you know, let me write a story.
And what do we mean technically? Going back to the language again, like what do we mean?
Yeah, there's no yes. And so I said, well, let me tell you a story about when I was living in Holland as a kid, and I just, you know, it was the academy that I was in, the town I lived in, fed into a bigger academy, so I wasn't a professional grade player, but we were given a task for a block of 6 weeks to attempt to get upwards of 10,000 touches a day on the ball, which the coaches said they knew we wouldn't get 10,000, but it was really kind of like, if you really wanted to count and be a robot, you could do that. But if you start thinking about extra game realistic movements, modeling those movements, then implementing into the game idea, you can improve your technical base. And so I wrote this article and it took off, but I've gotten so much resistance from it. And the thing is, I agree.
You were saying that was a good way to do it, or that's the way you do
it.
I said
that was the way. That's one way. But the problem with it is, people read it again. They read this as this is the way, and I said no. This is but one ingredient in the crock pot of what a football development model should be. Yeah. So you know, you could be an amazing technician like freestyle footballers, but tactically you can be a donkey. So it's literally one part of the puzzle. And I think people were so convinced that it had to be one way or had to be the other, opposed versus unopposed. So you did this really good essay. What's your take on this debate? And it is a debate.
Gosh, for sure. It's a real debate. I mean, I quite actually just like watching from the wings on Twitter.
It's the best. It's a social experiment.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of fun. When I did that video essay, I've shifted a little bit since then. But at that point, I was very much on the opposed, right? Just pretty solidly, pretty one mind, single minded on that, I have to say, when I made that. And actually, the motivation of making that was actually more to like try and provoke the people on the other side. And I think it was a provocation style video, and I did little flash mobs of flash screens of North Korea and stuff like that. You know, it was kind of cheeky. Right? But it was to provoke, because as far as I could tell, one of the problems is that the opposed, let's call it the opposed side, I think fits in with Verheyen's idea of what football action is. Not to go into it too quickly, but not to spend too much time on it, but it is any football action is comprised first of your interactions with your environment. So you interpret the stimuli, the ball, the opposition, the things that you can see and hear. That goes in. Then based on that, on those stimuli, you then go to, okay, what do I know about football? Your game insight. Do I pass forward? Do I pass sideways? Okay, you make a choice. Then, okay, so your choice is to pass. That is the skill. You're going to execute the skill of passing. And the technique is how that individual interpretation of how you execute that skill, which is a result of your game insight, which is derived from your communication with the stimuli, right? So it's all together, okay? So it's all together. You can't have a technique without the parts above it. Does that make sense? Is it the way I've sort of laid it? Yeah. Sure. So that's the opposed view of the nature of football. And that makes, and again, that makes sense to me. And also, so then I looked at empirical evidence, and the empirical evidence, I'm not one for reading, trawling through all these, they said, but I think it is important, you know, it is the scientific method, and it's good to keep abreast of what things are, you know, and what the general meta-analysis is and what the general thinking is. And the general thinking seems to be that, yes, if you employ an intervention that is opposed, then the skill acquisition or retention, I don't really know what those mean really, but okay, we're going to take it. Skill acquisition retention is higher if you make an intervention that is an opposed style of intervention over an unopposed. So there we have it. So what I had was, okay, I understand the explanation of this side, it makes sense, and I also understand that empirical data suggests that it's superior. Okay, so I go, right, okay, well, that's persuasive to me. So I make the essay. And I make it quite, because I'm on that side, I make it kind of provocative. But actually, I'm really glad I did it, because through that, a couple of people got in touch with me and challenged me on it. But in a nice way, you know, not in a, you know, in a good way. Say, have you seen such and such's method? Have you thought about this? And I'd never heard of Pepin Linders. I'm going to say that. I started watching all his stuff and learning about the way he did things. And he's totally so much of his stuff is unopposed, and I'm like, okay, well, that's interesting, because I looked at it, I was like, man, this is cool stuff. Some of his ideas are interesting. He's talking about a feel. He's got guys. Just, I don't know if people have seen the videos or if you've seen them, but you can get them on YouTube. Some of them, and he's got just kids just repeatedly volleying a ball into an empty net from like 2 yards away, right? And it's like, and he calls that feel for the net. I'm like, well, that's interesting. What's that? You know, what's feel for the net? So then I started thinking, well, okay, so the problem seems to be that the unopposed side don't really have an explanation of what technique is, don't really have an explanation of why it's better empirically. But that to me doesn't mean that it isn't. It just means no one's explained it properly yet, potentially. And the way I think of it now is that I think that of unopposed training is more like a psychological intervention in some way. It's like, if I want to do shooting practice, right, unopposed shooting practice, you know, just the layoff and you shoot it into the net or whatever. I mean, they do it. Manchester City were doing it before the game the other day, you know, like they were doing it, you know, unopposed shooting. And it's like, well, if you're a player and maybe you're low on confidence and whatever, and you don't think you can score a goal from 25 yards, but if you've just hit five into the top corner in your unopposed drill, right, and then when you go into a game and you're in that situation and you interpret the stimuli, maybe you're going to choose to shoot because you feel good about shooting. You know, maybe that's going to influence your game, your decision, because the way you feel about it. And I don't know how you measure that or anything like that, but to me that seems to make sense. If the zealots say that all you must ever do is opposed football training, then what do they make of taking the team out for a pizza? That's not game related. That's not opposed. That's making a psychological intervention to try and increase the probability that you're going to win a game. Something to do, but you're not playing a game of football. You're doing something else. You're trying to make them feel good. So it's something like that. That's kind of where I am just now.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned those principles, because I think so many people are mixing skill acquisition with skill application, and I think so many are mixing up foundational skill building and execution of a foundational skill. And I think my argument has always been this: unopposed training should, and this might change, and I've changed since 2013 or whenever when I wrote that. But the idea should be that the unopposed training should be reinforcing and introduction phase stuff, but it also should set you up for success in an opposed model. And so a good example that I use is Pep Linders had a really wonderful approach, and another coach that I worked with, Tim Lees, has had a really
I've seen his stuff as well. Yeah,
very good stuff. Very fascinating. He taught me a lot. Creating a complete player, creating the Maverick, or creating a player that could outplay. He doesn't use this term like beat them.
I've seen his presentation creating the Maverick.
It's outplaying. It's being able to use feints, turns, foundational movements, right? Unopposed. You rehearse it unopposed. You do it at speed. Yeah. And then you introduce a variable, which is the other player. And the other player might not even tackle. It just might be jockeying, shadowing. And then you let it go live. And what you see is the whole trajectory of unopposed to opposed. And I think that kind of ties into where, you know, anyone who says it's one way or the other, I think is a lunatic.
Yeah.
I really have to say that. But I think Tim and Pep and a lot of these great coaches have really – I think debunked that it should be one or the other. And I'm a big fan of a player going out to the garden and just juggling the ball. I'm doing kickups. That's
for sure.
Do it. But what I would be remiss to encourage, and I get on my players for this a lot, is if they show up to the pitch early and they start shooting on the net, that's their favorite activity, shooting on empty net.
Okay, well, that's everyone. I reckon pro teams still have to tell the players to stop doing that.
Right. Well, it was my favorite activity as a kid as well, until somebody actually stepped in and said, why don't you add something to this? And this is a fundamental part of my footballing education, which was an older player came up to me and said, why don't I serve a ball into you at pace? And then you can learn the movements to get that shot off in the first place. And that got the wheels turning. And I think that that's where people hopefully can get to is unopposed training is not the enemy, but you have to implement factors that would trigger success in an opposed setting. If that, I don't know if I'm making any sense, but.
That makes sense. It is difficult. I think the difficulty comes though, like when we're trying to describe what the benefit of might be of an unopposed setting is that there isn't this model. There isn't a model to use. And I'm not saying that has to be, but I think it makes it very difficult for people to understand the reason, the thinking behind it. Where I think there is a very, very clear structured model that seems to be well worked on the other side. So I think it's the job of people who are interested in unopposed training to really think really hard and try to come up with something more. It's always going on about models, but some kind of theory, some kind of written thesis on this to see what is it that we were doing here.
So I'm working on something similar, which is why that's actually the reason I put such a large number of touches in, which was, you know, the arbitrary amount is kind of the fun part. But, you know, when I train for a race, I'm not racing against other people. I'm actually racing against myself or the training model or the clock, right? And the clock's not going to lose. And like the ball, if you have a football, is not going to lose. The wall is not going to lose, I'm sorry, if you're striking it against that. So, but I think what I think is interesting is we live in a society where everything has to be measured, counted, and assessed.
Which is why I'm always wincing when I say model, you know? It's like,
Even that term, right? Even that term. Yeah. But I think, one of the most interesting arguments I had come my way, and you maybe had something similar when you did your video, which was, so my son gets, you know, 10,000 a day for 7 days, you know, I said, well, those should be supplemental to, you should still go to training. You should still play your games. You should still go play, you know, with your friends.
Yeah.
And I think but I paid the entry fee, which is the 10,000 or whatever the case may be, 1,000, say 1,000, you know, and I said, again, this is a fundamental approach to just increasing the number of repetition you get at game speed. You know, and I think that people sometimes need to separate the football from the task. And in the States and in Scotland, maybe it's similar. But
I think, John, do you think though, as soon as you start saying things like repetition into game speed, that's empirical stuff, though, isn't it? That's kind of empirical language. And if we're going to use empirical language, then you got to play the game of empiricism. And prove it. And that's the thing. And I think as soon as you go into empirical language, you're going to be met with, prove it. No, that's not right.
Right.
And I think that's kind of the problem. I think if people keep it to a more, that's why I liked Linder's the way he said it was feel for the net.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not empirical language. That's metaphorical language, right? So I actually think it's more metaphor or the language of metaphor that should be used more. Again, this is just something I'm thinking about, just for me, the way I conceptualize it. It's more of a psychological thing. It's more to do with a feeling than any kind of numbers or anything like that.
Right. I think to that point, there was some rudimentary analysis the club that I last worked for did, which was.
Oh, sorry. I jumped the gun here. Sorry.
No. You actually segued right into it, which is the average player gets, the average midfielder for our U16s got 40 touches a game in the ball, which is not a lot. For some of it's perfect. It doesn't matter, depending on the game and depending on the situation and the tactics. Mm-hmm. Some players got, you know, 100 plus. Some players got 10. You know, and so those happen to be the strikers. But we won 1-0, and that striker scored. So it was really interesting that I built this premise on, well, 1,000 touches a day is better, or 10,000, whatever.
Yeah.
But it didn't matter because come meaningful competition, opposed situation, the touches the number didn't matter. The quality did. And I think that's when Pep, and you're correct, it's like, it's the feel for it. It's the tactile thing. You know, and I think that is lost in the noise of whatever's going on. I think,
and that's the thing. Yeah, I think the unopposed, whatever you want to call it, the proponents of the unopposed, don't try and fight the battle on empirical grounds. It's something like that. Because you're going to lose.
You can try to beat Barcelona by playing like them, you're going to lose.
Yeah, exactly. So you're playing them at I'm not against it, but you're playing the other side where on their field. It's like, we'll try about shifting it slightly and move it into a more psychological realm where we're using a different kind of language. And that might lead to a better way of understanding it and understanding the benefits of it. Like anything these days, something that isn't empirical is often going to be labeled as pseudo. That doesn't necessarily mean it is, you know. But people are so obsessed with numbers that anything that isn't it's empirically shown and proven is immediately and rightly. But that's kind of right. You know, that is the right way to think about it. You should be skeptical, So absolutely, 100%. I'm not saying believe any crazy quack, but it's like. Yeah, it depends on the quality of the explanation. If the explanation is reasonable, then I think that stands up.
There's a great lesson, I think, for everybody listening is if you can extract a task from the sport. So, for instance, writing we both write. So most of the words that I write don't get published.
Mine too.
The words that I write, they go into draft or they get deleted. And that right there is kind of, you have to immerse yourself in a task and you have to execute when, not when it matters. I'm not putting, the proverbial gun against my head and say, better right now and it better be perfect the first time, but it takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of feeling and it takes a lot of mood and it takes, you can look at it that way, tone, mood, setting, environment, or you can look at it word count and time spent, you can look at it both ways. And I think they both matter, but I think the first one that I presented is probably better. I mean, maybe music's a better example, how a pianist or a guitarist trains and practices. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's...
It's a good one. I mean, if you take techno music, I mean, it's very electronic. Well, it is electronic music, right? And it's using, it's very minimal set of tools, very electronically derived. But the mood it creates, it's very interesting. It's very, very primal a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So you have that's what's so great about art, I think, and you have this marriage of this, again, going back to the chimp side of the brain and the rational side of the brain, and it has to be a dance, right?
Yes.
It's a dance.
It's
not them against us, because that's not going to end well,
that ends in conflict and nobody wins. So let's be respectful of your time. But what are you working on going forward? Do you have any good thing in the works that you'd like to maybe give people a preview on, or are you?
Hopefully, I have another, maybe some more articles coming out in these football times. Hopefully, I was talking about. I've been interested in the American thing that's happening, which a lot about, which maybe we don't have time to get into. I don't know, but I'm really interested in that.
We can chat about it a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested to get your take on it, because to me, it's like an absolute bloody tyranny over there. No?
So,
or is that too much? I don't know.
No. I think I'd agree with you, and I think people here know I'd agree with you. So, one of the things I found at the American game, and I'm a product of it, which is, as a business, whenever you take the game away from the people and you make it a business, you find yourself at odds with the essence of the game, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I think when I talk to my family in England and Ireland and a lot of them have given up their season tickets to Liverpool or wherever, and they've gone to non-league or they've gone to lower tier because they can afford it. They feel more connected with the product.
Yep.
They feel an identity. So the players from the city or the town are represented in the academy, and therefore, and I think in the States we have there's two narratives that I think are going on right now, which is. One, be thankful we have a model, and be thankful we have the game. And if it wasn't for these powers that be, we wouldn't have it, which is partly true. However, I think a lot of revisionist history.
Yeah. Sorry, actually, you just cut out. Sorry, you just cut out for 15 seconds there. Oh. Would you be able to just rewind? Yeah.
Sure. No. So I think there's two narratives that are present. One is the powers that be have given us the game, and it's true.
Yeah.
And they should be credited for that, and they funded a lot of it, and they've made some savvy moves on the business side. But there's a lot of revisionist and apologist arguments that, we have a version of the FA Cup called the U.S. Open Cup, which is the longest running non-interrupted, soccer competition. It has a great history and a great heritage, but it's not really celebrated. And I think you're starting to see that in England, too, with the FA Cup losing some of its, luster. But here in the States, it's in my opinion, and I've written about this, it's very monopolized where, there is no true pyramid. It's not even, it's really just kind of what the powers, the business entities say can exist. So you cannot have a Leicester City. You cannot have any Davids. You can only have Goliaths, and the Goliaths here aren't even that good, because how could they be? There's no competition. There's no capitalist competition. It's very, it's not an open market. So for instance, if I have a bread shop and you have a bread shop, and you know, I happen to do less good work than you do, you should obviously outcompete me, and you should probably drive me out of business if we're across street from each other. Well, here is, you have a bread shop and it's mediocre, and I have a bread shop that's mediocre, and there's someone who wants to open up their own bakery, and they're really good, but they didn't they didn't get authority, or they didn't get permission to do so. So you and I can conspire to shut them down. And again, there's a million ways to splice this apart, but I think in terms of football models, business models, I'm sorry, and economics, it's a very dangerous game to play if you want to be the people's game. Because what's happening is, in an effort to be the Premier League or to be the NFL or to be something, we've cut off basically everybody except for 20 outlets. I wouldn't even call them clubs or franchises. And MLS is the club. So they belong. So in MLS, the league owns the players. The players sign a contract with the league, and then the league can authorize who can go where and how much they get paid. And it's very totalitarian. And at a certain point in time, that was necessary. I think now I disagree that it is necessary. And I think a lot of people are like, well, John, now how could you, you know, knock the domestic league? And I'm like, it's really not against it. It's the model that I'm actually against. Right. It's not that I don't wish any ill, you know, on anybody, but I feel that for a country of our size and a country of our population diversity and infrastructure strength, I think the time is to take the training wheels off has come. But, you know, I think you can't have fairy tale stories here. You can't have that. It's not allowed, really. I mean, it's not even a, you know, people can't even dream it up. I mean, if I have a great club and we have good funding and we do things the right way, if my players get taken for professional teams, I don't even get compensation for that. They just get taken. So it's like, it's real.
I mean, to me that, to me that, I mean, I know you, I mean, I wasn't, you know, I've not experienced of living in America or being part of US soccer like you have, but, and you said there that you thought at one point it was necessary. I don't know about that, but to me, I mean, it's just the fundamental structure of that is, to me, like you say, it's totalitarian. And I would not, I mean, how can you have a, I mean, look at it in terms of the way a society is structured. You can't have a system that denies entry. Like every single person must have the same equality of opportunity, right? That's what liberalism is. That's what it is.
It's actually in our constitution.
Right. It's in the in America of all bloody places, right? Yeah. This is happening. I mean, and the thing is, right, it's a free market, which I absolutely support. So MLS, in my view, can run their company however they want and just never be forced to do anything they don't want to do. No problem. You can run your closed shop. So I mean, I don't know the dynamics of, but obviously all the media companies are going to be in bed with them, right? And the writers. Yeah, and the writers that support them. I mean, they're not football writers, are they? I mean, please.
I argue they're not.
Absolutely. They're just on the payroll. They're absolutely not. Because it has to be, like you said, it has to be an open pyramid, open to all. The person, the lowest person in the footballing society can aim for the very, very top of that pyramid.
Well, it's the American dream, isn't it? It's, you know,
exactly. This is what. Yeah, I mean, I would not accept being part of a society that wasn't the case. If you have, just take it. Imagine you had entry requirements to be a political party, and no one, you know, no way. That's not on. That's tyranny. Well, and that's what I see from the outside.
You mentioned the writing, and I think I've gotten a lot of criticism for saying there's a line in that people call it an essay, but that article says.
Yeah, no, I read that, and I really highlighted some of the things I was thinking about. No, I enjoyed
which
that
is
one.
Which is there's a lack of journalistic integrity, and I think I taught journalism for a bit, and I have a secondary degree in journalism, and I'm not a journalist. I never want to make people confused that I'm a journalist. But someone mentioned to me how hard journalists work, you know, for the league and for the federation. And I said, well, let me counter with this. I don't make money writing. I don't. I coach multiple teams. I train multiple players. I'm a new father. I have a day job. What everyone has their thing. So I think it's hard. That's the work that football writers do, not just me, but who research, read the books, compile information. do it for free. And there's no template. There's no quick game template, game match report template. There's no audience that's already being prepped to pander. You have to convince them. I think that that's actually truly hard work. And I'm not saying journalists don't have a hard job, but they have access. They have resources. Sure. They have a platform. They have...
don't you think that when you get hit with these, okay, well, we work really hard. Okay, so what? No one's saying you don't, right? What I'm saying is what you're working hard in favor of is morally wrong.
Sure.
Right? So it's a moral argument. And people, and that's just the thing, and people try the sleight of hand. Oh, well, economics this, and well, you know, hard. Well, that's fine. You can say that economics is more important than morals if you want, right? But that, I'm not going to go to that place. I say, no, morally, it's wrong. So if you're complicit in that, then you're a part of it. And you can say how hard you work to be immoral. that's not an argument as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think you're right. And I think I know you're right. And here's the fundamental problem with people get hung up on the promotion relegation debate. And I think before we even get into that, it's like that's not even allowed to take place. Like the argument itself is taboo now, and I think that that's a problem. And so now you've eliminated, you've been censored. So there's free speech is kind of at odds. And if you so there's totalitarian.
It's Orwellian. They're getting censored as well.
Yeah, it's Orwellian. It's like the party says no. And I feel like every day there's a 2 minutes hate in 1984 where you kind of.
Yeah, well, it's double speak. It is double speak. The people that say, and this is the problem, and I have to be clear as well. If MLS were just open, and again, you'll know more about this than I would, but if MLS just say, we care about money, and we are a company that wants to make as much money from the game of football as possible, and it's basically to the detriment of the national game, then I'm fine with that.
Yeah,
right? To be honest, like, no problem. Right? They don't work for people. Yeah, of course, you can run your company whatever way you want to. It's a free country, right? But if you're at the if you're going to run your company like that, but simultaneously publish propaganda that tries to influence people that what you're doing is for the benefit of the game and all in America, then that to me is doublespeak. That, and like you said, it's Orwellian.
It is, and people have really I think a lot of people need to read more literature. I really do. I mean, this is like not even a football thing. I think people need to educate themselves on the functions of society and how certain lessons we learn from our literature and our resources can play out. And I think one of the saddest things that has happened is a lot of players that we produce, they get to the level that they're at despite the system, not because of it, which is a really sad way to think about it, because how many are being – and again, this isn't about professional players. This is about players of all abilities, coaches of all abilities. Yeah. This is about you saying, I want to start my own football club. I'm going to run it out of the pub, and we're going to make a run in the U.S. Open Cup or our FA Cup.
Yep.
And I hope that with good funding, with good decision making, with good business practice, we could hopefully hit a ceiling that is football, not business. Yep. And we could, and I think people.
It's a meritocracy, right? It's a meritocracy. Yes, that's what it should be. Yeah.
And I think the structure of, I've always envisioned a day and age where MLS is its own thing, it's on its own island. And. Yep. The federation, through some reform, could have its own separate, like they can let it be its business. And if you that's what you subscribe to, the Americanized schema, great.
Yeah.
But if you want to be on the global model and let players, let the global market, let players have the same transfer period as players in Europe and South America and in Africa and Asia, like I don't understand why it has to be so different. And I think a lot of this comes down to the business is – first and foremost, football is last. And I think you're ruining a lot of people. And I don't mean to be dramatic here, but I think a lot of people's hopes and dreams are tied to the game. And I think that you deny opportunity, and that's very un-American, in my opinion.
For sure. And you can see this thing, again, you'll know more about than I would, this thing that this is happening at Columbus, right? Mm. They're now being told that they're going to have to move to Austin or something. Is that right? I mean, so that's how they treat fans. That's how they think of football. It's like, well, that nothing like that's important. All the history or these fans have worked toward, the people of that club have linked with the city and all these kind of things that I'm sure are very, closely tied. It's just not. It doesn't matter. And numbers don't add up. See you later.
Right. In culture, whatever culture has been built, and this is the franchise model. I mean, back in – and this isn't just MLS. I mean, the Brooklyn Dodgers moved to L.A., I mean, this historic baseball team, you know, the Baltimore Colts moved to Indianapolis. And so franchise models allow business to triumph and business to overpower societal fabric of to a team. And I think what is dangerous with this is American fans aren't stupid. They see the European model, they see South American model. Most of us are only one or two generations removed from Europe or South America or Asia. We're a global country. I mean, I think most of us have been spoiled with phenomenal coverage of the world's game, and we have heroes and narratives that we subscribe to. And I think when you deny it in a country that prides itself on being independent and being, you know, freedom to do what you want, be successful if you put your mind to it, I think it's disingenuous to call
100%
this a functional model for football, for soccer.
And I think
they could admit that, that would be, you know, and maybe they do, but I think people need to, I think fans need to demand more of their communities. And I think until reform happens, you're going to continue to see these, you know, articles from me, but you're going to see this debate rage on because it's important.
Yeah, I think the message, I think you touched on something. People use this excuse of, well, the model works for NFL, the model works. But you're not competing against the world in those sports.
Nope.
That's the point. It's like, maybe if you were, you'd see how rubbish it was. You know, it's like, because, yeah, I just think, I think the more people that are fighting for the rights of, like you say, an individual who wants to start their own team, has a pathway to the professional elite level game, more people that fight for that and inform people that that is what is possible, then I think the better, for sure.
There's a Stockholm syndrome of American soccer, which
in bondage.
Which is interesting, which is, well, the owners have paid money, the billionaires have paid money, how can you take that away from them? Like, I've never understood why people only in this arena care about what billionaires lose or win. In our society,
a rubbish thing to care about.
It is. It's a cheap thing to care about, but it's also, we live in a society where we love to see people fail and fall, and they deserve it because they're a celebrity, they can afford it. And all of a sudden, with when it comes to, you know, the owners and operators in MLS, like, well, no, they put money up. We should defend them. It's like, they don't care if you go hungry.
It's propaganda working.
Yes, and I think that you know, Jamie, I would really like to actually, I'd love to see you write about something like this from your perspective, because I think, you know, there could come a day and age where, you know, there's a European Super League where it's closed off and it's only the top four teams of a couple countries, and, you know, what does that do for everyone? I mean, I'm just speculating here, but
as long as there's a pathway, that's the thing. It's like the Champions League. People say the Champions League is elitist. Well, it's not really, is it? Because anyone can actually win it, theoretically. Structure-wise, okay, in reality, okay, maybe not, but, you know, Atletico Madrid nearly win it, Dortmund nearly win it. No, you can. It's getting harder and harder, I understand, but who's going to say Red Bull Leipzig aren't going to win it? Right. And it's like, well, okay, but they're Red Bull. But yeah, but someone started a business, so maybe you have to start a business first. Then maybe that you're allowed to... No, it's not easy. Right? No one said it was going to be easy, right? But maybe that's the initiative you have to show. And I'm interested in the guy Spencer Rowan, who starts his own club called Hashtag United off a YouTube channel. And he's got 2 million followers. Well, that just seems like a smart way to start a football club to me, to get funding, to get exposure for players. And who says that kind of model couldn't take off? People using the internet to market their own football clubs. I mean, why not? It's the way the world's going. So as long as there's a pathway from the bottom to the top, a pyramid, exactly, then I'm kind of cool with it. And people complain about, oh, it's the elitism. Well, maybe, Spencer Owen can start his own club. That means anyone can.
Yep.
So why not? Show some initiative. Instead of complaining about it, then maybe go off and, have them do something about it.
Well, I mean, it's also about creating local economies, too. I think if you start a football club, I'm in your town, and I could sponsor you, or I could, you know, your players can do a photo op with my kids. Or, you know, I think that that's truly the essence that's lost as well, is people helping people, businesses helping, angel investors coming in. You know, you want to look at it from the top and the bottom. And I think the fabric of a community, I mean, my sister lives in County Wicklow in Ireland, and, you know, there's like AFC Roundwood and like some of these small teams, but they're tied to the town. And, you know, I think they matter. You know, you go to Greystones and there's a team there, and it's just like...
Well, I've been coaching in the fifth division of Scottish football, and it's brilliant. I love going to those places, like all these amazing old clubs,
everyone helps out, and you know the community help out, serving the food and making doing the cleaning and all this. Like that's just what it's about. You know that's football, and it's you know that's the power of the team, the power of the collective, which is important. You know, as much, but it also takes it's also important for the individuals to have the ability to start something of their own and make that collective around something important, a totem pole of some kind. That's what football is to me. It's a marriage between individual and collective as well, which again is something that played out politically, like not particularly to good ends a lot of the time. But that's why I like football so much. It gets again, it's a dance between the individual and the collective, and that has I think if you deny pyramid structures, then you're just denying the opportunity to individuals to make these important collectives, and I think that's a travesty, really.
It's if you deny pyramid structures, you get pyramid schemes. And I think, yeah. You know, and that's yeah. A really, you know, people really need to understand that there's a great book that a friend of mine, Seth Burkett, who's an English, he played in Brazil. He's written a book called The Boy in Brazil. And there's a chapter in there where he says the local people came out to cut the grass with scissors. They brought stools out and they were
saying,
it's just like, again, I'm not saying that we have to have this romanticized, you know, Oliver Twist view of the game, but I do feel that there is a place for that in the United States. There's a place for that everywhere. There's enough soccer hotbeds or cultures that could find happiness in maybe their kids attend a game instead of, you know, pick up a gun or pick up, you know, I think that there's like a fundamental thing where the game could save people. And to just say there's 20 outlets that represent a country of 350 million, that's the landmass of, you know, Western Europe, I think that's just a tragedy in a lot of ways. And I don't know that people, you know, see it that way, but I do. And I think a lot of people are starting to wise up and maybe, you know, empathize with that. Right. But
Well, our articles like yours will help, John, for sure. And I think, the more people that get on board with that, then I'm in full support. And maybe I'll weigh in at some point.
So where can people find you on social media, Jamie?
Twitter is that's where I am. Sterling @Sterling_J, and I tweet not as much as I used to, probably. I tweet less these days, but it takes up a lot of time and energy, I've realized, and it gets very tiring. So I tweet about football or other things as well, general things of interest, but you can contact me there for sure.
Well, Jamie, I'm going to get you on this podcast again because I think we have a ton of stuff to talk about. I think we barely scratched the surface.
Thank you for listening to the Coaches Forum by These Football Times. Be sure to check out These Football Times online for some of the best long-form, authentic journalism and football storytelling on offer.